Joe Kane's journey down the Amazon River started with a phone call from a stranger. The caller hoped to be the first man to navigate the 4,200-mile length of the Amazon. He was organizing an expedition, and he was looking for a writer to chronicle the journey. At the time, Joe Kane was writing for a San Francisco newspaper and for the Coevolution Quarterly. He decided to join the expedition. Joe Kane has just finished the book about the trip. It's called Running the Amazon. Kane was the only American in the 10-person team, and several of the 9 other members shook the little confidence he had. The leader of the expedition was slightly crippled from polio and had a reputation for sloppily planned trips. One of the members had chronic brucellosis, a condition that often left him depressed, extremely lethargic, and feverish. Another man was 52, had a degenerating disc, an arthritic hip, and was overweight. Only Joe Kane and one other man paddled the full length of the river. I asked Kane what he expected his role to be when he joined the expedition as the writer.
At first, at least the way it was presented to me when I was going down there, was that I wasn't supposed to do anything. In fact, I was supposed to shadow the expedition by truck. There was supposed to be a big escort vehicle that would rendezvous with the kayakers every 2 to 3 weeks. And I was simply supposed to chronicle the expedition. I had no duties outside of that. However, once I landed in Peru, I realized that, in essence, I had been sold a bill of goods. There was no expedition vehicle. Eventually, the man who was to later become the expedition leader, Piotr Malinsky, rounded up a Land Rover. Clearly, that couldn't hold me, and it couldn't hold the other expedition members it was supposed to carry. And we wound up hiking the first 150 miles of the river on foot, all in the high Andes up above 15,000 feet. At that point, my role in the expedition started to shift. Actually, it shifted right from the start in Peru in that I was assigned to help coordinate food supplies with another Polish man, Zbigniew Bizdak, who was our photographer. Later, when we got down into the big Whitewater Gorge, I was the quartermaster. I was in charge of making sure that we had supplies and that food was equally distributed and that there was no mildew in the bags and things like that. It was the lowest work on the expedition, without a doubt. But it became my means of establishing myself within the expedition and not simply as an outsider.
When you realized that you'd been sold a false bill of goods, why didn't you just leave?
That's a good question. Well, partially in a very crass way, I was on the hook. I owed these thousands of dollars to people, and I had made a deal with the publisher. But on a deeper level, I was in. You know, I had the bit in my mouth. I got sick right away in Peru, and as soon as I got over that, I started thinking, boy, I am in a different kind of place. This is my fantasy. I left home really on the run and not sure what I was looking for, but just knowing that I was bored silly with my life. You know, I had a girlfriend, and we would probably get married soon. I had a job that was steady, if nothing else, and fairly interesting. I was with the old Coevolution Quarterly, and it was a fun crew. But when I got right down to it, I was bored silly, and I realized that it was a matter of there just not being enough in my life that was raw. You know, everything seemed so cut off. So although the expedition clearly had huge problems from the get-go, we were flat broke before we even got on the river. At the same time, here was an experience that I couldn't walk away from, and and being a writer especially, I knew that there was a story there, and I wanted to chase it. It was as simple as that, I think.
You got to the source of the Amazon high in the Andes, and that's where the official expedition began. But you'd already suffered through mountain sickness before you got on the Amazon. Would you describe what the source of the Amazon looked like to you when you approached it?
Well, for us, and I think for anybody, the source, you have to say it's more symbolic than real. You really can't point to a square foot of ground and say, this is where the Amazon starts. We climbed right to the continental divide, the South American continental divide, climbed to 18,000 feet. It was a high tundra, I suppose would be a good description of it. It was a glacier, or had been a glacier, and now with changing weather conditions had degenerated to a snowfield. And we simply went over the continental divide, only a matter of a few hundred yards, and found an ice fall there, a frozen sheet of white ice, probably 25 feet high, and called that the source of the Amazon. It reached the proportions or the extent that one of the guys climbed up on the top of the ice fall and spit over the side and said, well, that makes me the source of the Amazon. You can't narrow it down any more than that. And then the idea was to follow the runoff until it built a body of water that would support kayaks, and then from there to run it 4,200 miles out to the Atlantic.
My guest is Joe Kane, author of the new book, Running the Amazon. Well, you had to negotiate a lot of rapids along your journey through the Amazon. Would you describe the worst rapid that you had to run?
Sure. In a way, for 6 weeks. It felt like we were running one continuous rapid. I should describe just what the river does through there. It it drops that 18,000 feet in about 600 miles. And at one point, it runs through a gorge that's 10,000 feet deep, which is twice as deep as the Grand Canyon. It runs at a gradient of about five times the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, all of which meant nothing to me. I had never been on a whitewater river. I had never been in a raft or a sea kayak. I had intertubed on the Sacramento River in California, trailing a six-pack of beer, and that was my vision of what it was going to be. I had even, you know, bought my Indiana Jones felt safari hat and my khaki shirt and all. But the rapids in the Apurimac, which is the furthest tributary of the Amazon, it is, again, the deepest land gorge on the planet. And the whitewater just comes in rapid after rapid after rapid, almost like a waterfall, a long, continuous waterfall. They got bigger and bigger until finally when we entered the deepest part of the gorge called the Acobamba Abyss, where the walls were 10,000 feet and just sheer. Sheer is the walls on the side of your house and quite narrow, sometimes only 50 yards across. That's where the whitewater really got crazy because there was simply no way that you could avoid it. There was no way out. There were no trails leading from the canyon. You couldn't climb out. If someone got injured, they'd have to be strapped on the raft, and we would simply have to run this gorge. We knew by that point that at least five expeditions had tried to run this area before. None had succeeded, and two had ended with drownings. One was a 1976 expedition, a West German expedition, well-financed, that the captain drowned 3 minutes after he got in the water. Once we got in the gorge, we realized that the 40 miles we had hoped to run in perhaps 5 days would take much longer. We were lucky to make a mile a day, and we cut rations to half and then down to a quarter. And at the same time, terrible squabbling broke out within the expedition. I had taken several swims. I took swims every day, which simply means that I was pitched out of the raft in a rapid, you know, bounced over the side one way or another. I was the left rear paddler. But boy, one day we hit a rapid that you could see it. It was a class 6, unrunnable. But there was no way around it for the raft. We couldn't portage it. And we just had to go. We shot the top okay. We got it in good position on the chute right above it. But then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened. Everything went black all around me. I was freezing cold. I just felt myself being sucked. And what I assumed was down, I couldn't even tell what was up or down. I could see no light whatsoever. I tried as hard as I could to swim, and I just couldn't. The water just pinned my arms to me. Something hit me in the chest, knocked all the air out of me, and then I just knew. I knew for a fact that I was drowning. And I remember thinking quite clearly, this is it. I was a fool to come here, and this is what a fool gets. I was a dead man. And then like that, there was a moment of this peace and clarity. I kind of just gave up. I knew that there was nothing I could do. And then the river spit me out as if I wasn't good enough. And I bounced up, and I saw our lead kayaker, Jerome Turin, down below me, probably 50 yards below me, in his kayak, just waiting below the big water, and he just yelled, swim, and I couldn't even react. I was sucked back down again and bounced off the river. Everything was blackness, and I kept getting banged in the head. And I came up again, and luckily I came up right near Jerome, and he fished me out of the river, brought me over to a sandbank, and sort of deposited me there. He had to go rescue the raft crewman as well. And I just sat there and threw up for about 5 minutes. And then that night, it just came to me. I was sitting in that camp all alone and thinking, I don't know any of these people here. They have no obligation to me. If I drown, they don't have to go back to my family and friends and explain things. I was the only American. And that's when it really hit me. The only way out of there was to run that river, and I had to learn how to do it. And at the same time, the two Polish men, Piotr and Zbyszek, came to me and said, look, we're going to make it, and we're going to make sure you make it. And that was it. The expedition split shortly after that.
So you had no choice? There was no way of walking away from this once you realized how dangerous it was?
No, not in that part of the river. There was no way out. That's when I knew this, you know, this wasn't Indiana Jones. This was the real thing. And I had better start paying attention, or I wasn't going to make it.
Did you feel like a jerk then? You know, like, what the heck have I done? What have I gotten myself into?
I certainly did. But I should also say that I think I realized that was a useless thing to think about. Because uh-huh. Jerk or not, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to pay attention. It was a feeling of you can't relax. You can't let go. Because if you make one mistake, that's it. You know, watch what these guys are doing. See what they do. See how they react. Talk to them. Study. Learn how to be on this raft. And so it became, in that way, it became very rewarding because it was a kind of discipline. And it certainly gave me that sense of, here's real life. This is the rawness I was looking for. And the lesson of it was, if you're in that kind of situation, you don't relax.
Well, the people on the expeditions ended up really at odds with each other, and the person who was the head of the expedition lost the confidence of the people who he'd taken along. This kind of came to a head when Odendahl, the head of the expedition, asked you to leave. What did he tell you, and what kind of deal did he try to strike with you?
Well, he tried to sell it as a package. It focused on me, but at different points up to then, it had focused on other people in the expedition, too. He had gone to various members and tried to get them out one way or another. We all sort of realized that what was happening was that once we got through the worst part of the river, he was going to try and force us off the expedition and narrow it down to perhaps three or two men, himself, his close friend Tim, and Piotr, because he had to take Piotr.
He wanted to narrow it down so there'd be more glory for him, or
I don't,
more food,
you know,
for
I
him?
Really don't know. That was certainly the feeling among the other members of the expedition, that it was a very vainglorious sort of pursuit for him to attempt to get us out of there. And I think that's what caused us all to come together, because we really did stand up as a group and say, no, you are not the expedition leader anymore. It's our expedition. You're welcome to stay, but we're not going to follow these kind of rules anymore. They're not for the best of the expedition. And the man who really put that across was Jerome Turin. He was our best kayaker by far. He was an international champion. He was the one man who was never swept into the water, never really at the mercy of the river, and the man who saved all our lives again and again. He had known Odendahl. Their relationship went back many years, and he had seen this happen before. And he, once we were trapped and in bad, you know, in a bad situation, he came to me and to Zbyszek and to Piotr and said, look, clearly you guys don't know the history here, but there's a lot more going on than just us trying to get down this river. Francois is chasing some ghosts, and he will stop at no end to relieve his own inner burden. We mutinied. I think that's the only real accurate way to describe it. Although Odendahl demanded a vote of confidence, and we gave him an overwhelming vote of no confidence, and he did leave the river shortly after that.
Well, several people left the expedition. Why did it break up?
A lot of reasons. We had planned to take 3 to 4 months on the river. After 3 months, we had covered a grand total of 600 miles out of a 4,200-mile river. Given that was the worst and most treacherous water, but still, we were so far behind. We were virtually flat broke. When you look at most expeditions, the budgets are, you know, million-dollar budgets or multi-million-dollar budgets, and I think we went all the way down that river for about $25,000. Everybody was tired. Nobody was terribly sick, but people were worn down. There was no doubt about that. We had been... For 6 weeks, it had been literally every day. You'd wake up and you'd think, boy, am I going to make it through it today or not? And that the grinding that places on the personalities was, it was a big factor. And people were tired. That's it. They just left for those reasons, I think.
So finally, there were just two of you who stayed on the river the whole time, who actually kayaked the complete length.
That's right. I should say, in fairness, it really was four, in that Zbyszek, our photographer, and Kate, our doctor, Kate Durant, who was also the only woman on the expedition, they said, you know, we'll stay, and we're going to go, and we'll carry the medical supplies, and we'll carry the emergency food, and we will drop it as we can in key places along the river so that you can get it, and we'll try and join up with you all along the way. But then, yes, it came down to Piotr, who Piotr is an Iron Man. I can't describe him in any other terms, really. He was going to make it one way or another. He would swim the river if he had to. But he asked me, he said, look, we've got two sea kayaks here. Would you join me? I don't want to do this alone. And I figured in for a dime, in for a dollar. We've come this far, why not? So I said, sure, I'll do it. Let's go. And we set off on a journey of 3,600 miles.
What was it like after being in a mountainous region and negotiating rapids for so long, to hit sea level and placid waters and to be in the middle of the jungle?
The physical difference, at least for me, was that I was no longer in this mortal fear of for my life every day. But by the same token, the physical demands were much greater. We were paddling an extraordinary length. I had no idea. I had never been in a sea kayak, so I didn't know what it meant. And after the second day, I just sat there in my boat one day. I stopped, you know, it was 100 degrees out, and my head was just throbbing, and I was completely exhausted, and I calculated how far it was out to the Atlantic. And it was 3 million paddle strokes, which was, it made the act of executing a single stroke pathetic and almost useless. Physically and emotionally, it became a matter of adjusting to this routine over day after day after day, minute after minute, hour after hour. That was the most profound difference for me personally. But then the exterior was the, we were back sort of in the land of the living. Down in the big Amazon, there are villages, there are Indians of various types down there. And you do see, after a certain point, you do see other travelers on the river now and then. And in the big white water, we were completely alone. There was no way, no way into that abyss and no way out of it, and people did not go down there.
What shape were you in when you finally arrived at the mouth of the Amazon where it meets up with the ocean?
I was underweight, I'll say that. I'm not big, I'm 5'10", 155 pounds usually, and I was down to about 135 pounds at that point. My wrists were inflamed. I had what is called tenosynovitis, an inflammation of the tendon sheaths in the wrist, a fairly common distance kayaking affliction. I was strong, but I was exhausted, frankly. And I would like to say that we reached the ocean with a sense of euphoria, but it wasn't that. It was a sense of, wow, well, we did it. Let's go. Let's go take a nap. The real euphoria didn't set in for a few months after we got home.
What did you do the day after?
The day after, actually, we had television crews came out of Brazilian television, and we sort of reenacted the crossing of the ocean. But the most jarring event afterwards was that we went down to Rio de Janeiro. We were given free plane tickets. We were flat broke at that point again, as we had been most of the journey. And Good Morning America contacted us down there and said, look, we'll fly you home for free if you'll be on our show. So literally 3 days after we had been camping on the in the mud on the Amazon, we were touring downtown Manhattan in these limousines and staying in $300 night suites in the middle of winter. It was 6 below, and it was jarring. Kate and Zbyszek and I barricaded ourselves in my hotel room and got a big bottle of wine and a bag of sandwiches and just stayed there until we were on television.
That really does sound disorienting. Your job on this expedition was to chronicle it. Now, you know, you had hoped to come back and write a book, and that's what your purpose was. They wanted someone to write about the expedition. That's why they asked you to join.
That's right.
So I assume you were taking notes throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you self-conscious when you were writing while you were on the journey? Like, what kind of tone should I strike here? After all, you were carrying the portable Conrad in your knapsack.
Striking dark and dark vision. I didn't even worry about it at that point. The real job, as I saw it, was to make sure I had the details down, just to get the notes down. I mm-hmm. made myself write 1,000 words a day, every night, even if it was just about the dirt under my fingernails, just to make sure I had something down when I came back. At first, it was exhausting, because I'd work all day. First, it was hiking all day, and then it was paddling the river all day, and then at night, I'd have to sit down and fill all these blank pages in my notebook. But after a while, perhaps after the first even 2 weeks of the expedition, when I was feeling particularly alienated from the rest of the people, since I didn't really know them, the notebooks became my place almost of refuge. It was a place I went where I knew what my job was, I knew what I had to do, and I knew how to do it. And I could sit there and write and do the work. Sometimes it meant falling asleep with my face down in the notebook and waking back up again to keep on. But it really was something that I grew to like, to look forward to in the day.
How did you manage to hold on to the notebooks, considering you were almost killed yourself? You almost drowned.
It was, frankly, it was tricky. I showed up in addition to my safari hat and my epauletted khaki shirt, I also showed up in South America with a waterproof briefcase, which I was roundly derided for it. But once we got on the raft, that thing was a jewel. I could tuck my notebooks, and I had a tiny little micro cassette recorder, and my pens, and I could tuck them into the briefcase and tuck that in turn under the center net on the raft. And then whenever we got a break, I could yank it out and very quickly scribble down the notes, whatever my impressions were, snatches of conversation, descriptions, things like that. And then at night, go back and organize it into more of a narrative. So that became a very important tool. The other thing that I was really worried about with keeping notes was that they not be washed away and not be obliterated by the water. So I had the micro cassette recorder, and every 3 or 4 days I would read the previous sections of my diary into the micro cassettes, then wrap them in duct tape. And after a certain point, I was able to send a batch of those out by mule and back to the United States. And in fact, they all made it intact. And those were my backup notes.
That's really remarkable. Now that you're making a name for yourself from this book, Running the Amazon, in order to keep writing, are you going to have to go on more death-defying expeditions?
That's a shame, isn't it, when you have to you have to push it that far to get a book out of it. No, I'm not. I'm certainly not enamored of the idea of risking my life for a story. This happened accidentally. I did not ever think that my life would be in danger when I first set out on it. I'd like to write a book on adventure gardening. You know, how to raise really wild tomatoes, that kind of thing. I certainly would like to go out and be in a very wild place again. But on the other hand, you don't want to, or I don't want to, have that label of, oh yeah, he's just that fool who goes out and goes these crazy places. It's nice to be, well, to be every man, to be just a normal person, and then put yourself in a really wild situation.
Oh, can we end on one of those big impossible questions? I really would like to know if you think any more or any less about death now that you're home safe and sound.
Frankly, no, not about death so much, but I do think about direct experience, I guess, for want of a better description. I really am convinced that the whole bent of Western culture is to veil experience, and I don't say that in a pejorative way, because who wants to feel pain? What kind of fool chases that kind of thing? But by the same token, I definitely feel that we've lost something. The culture really has no tradition of a walkabout or a vision quest or anything like that, as so many indigenous cultures do, where you remove yourself from your normal life and do something wild and then come back and live your normal life, knowing what the extremes are and what the boundaries are that are out there. So for me, while I don't think about death, I do think about, well, just how tame am I allowing myself to be, and how can we get out there and push that envelope, I guess, a little bit more.
Joe Kane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.